What if you didn't care about being on the fast track? What if you decided to help someone else get ahead? Peace Corps, life is calling. How far will you go? To find out more, call 800-424-8580 or visit peacecorps.gov.
This is Out There. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Today's show is mostly an interview with Kaylin, who lives in Northampton and wrote the book Talking About Race, a workbook about white people fostering racial equality in their lives. The book was published in 2010, and you can get it at Bradside Books in downtown Northampton. Before I start in with the interview with Kaylin, let's see, I have a bike path story. I have a couple of bike path stories to share. One is I got an envelope in the mail the other day addressed to me at my house with no return address, and I opened it up, and inside there was a check for $35 from River Valley Market addressed to me, a well-worn check dated October, and there was a little post-it note that said, found on the bike path. So thanks to whoever found my check and took the time to mail it to me. I have another bike path story, which in my archived edition of Out There, which, by the way, is at weatherbeard.com/Ruthie, R-U-T-H-Y. All my past shows out there, you can see all 10 past shows. Thanks to Alex for the technological help in that and for all your tech help. But anyway, this little story I put on a past show, but I didn't say it live. So I want to tell this story from earlier this fall. One morning, I was going up the bike path, from like Straw Ave up towards Cooper's Corner in Florence. And about halfway up the path, there's woods on both sides, and people like to throw their leaves and yard waste over the edge. So it sort of tumbles down the edge towards the path. And in one of those places where someone had thrown a bunch of leaves, there was this 5 or 6 foot tall potted plastic ficus plant. And I thought, well, that's kind of odd. Did someone mistake plastic for biodegradable material? But stranger things have happened, so I kept about my business. And then later on that day, I was home, and a friend of mine stopped by, my friend Dennis. Dennis and his daughter, Kaylin, stopped by, and Dennis had the plant with him. And he said, hey, look what I found up on the bike path. I'm going to take it home and put it in my apartment. It'll look nice next to the other plastic ficus plant I got in there. And I thought that was kind of funny. And then as we're standing there, his friend Jace walks up, and Jace says, oh, yeah, I was coming back from Cooper's Corner last night, and that plant was sitting next to the Cooper's Corner dumpster, and I thought, that'll look good in my apartment. So I picked it up, and I was walking down the bike path with it, and it was pretty on the bike path with the trees and stuff, and I thought, I'll just take a picture of the plant here. And so he set the plant down, and he took a picture on his cell phone, and he texted it to his girlfriend, said, hey, look what I got. And she said, don't bring that thing here. And so Jay said, so I just left it. So that's as much as I know of that ficus plant. All right, so I'm going to go into the interview with Kaylin. We talked for quite a while on Sunday, and so I edited the clips a lot, and some of it might not quite be as coherent as I would like. But anyway, here it is.
So Kaylin, can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Hi. I was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. I moved to Northampton in 1991 and had lived in Seattle, Washington, also in Montgomery, Alabama. I was raised upper class. I think that's important. The brownstone that I was raised in Park Slope, Brooklyn, was created by the same architect who did Forbes Library here. My father was the Dodger's eye doctor, Jackie Robinson's eye doctor. You know, I went to Catholic schools as a child and in college. And then I quit and met George Williams. And George Williams is a black guy from Brooklyn, New York, who many people here know locally in Northampton and knew locally. He died 4 years ago. And worked for the Veterans Education Project and Veterans for Peace. And he and I got together right away. We married right away and had two children. And you know, I was encountering racism so much during that whole process that it really took me by surprise. What took me by surprise was white people's obsession with racism and their lack of acknowledgement of it and their sense of entitlement regarding it, the violence that's inherent in it. And it just seemed bizarre to me that you could despise people you don't know. In the homes I was raised in, most people had black maids. And that was also kind of weird. So I had this consciousness regarding racism ever since I was a little girl. When I was 7, when my father asked me what I wanted for Christmas, I wanted a black doll. And he went all over New York looking for one and apparently could not find one. But he made that effort to find one for me. So I was always gauging consciousness that had to do with color. Also knowing that I wasn't going to be accepting it. I wasn't going to be accepting prejudice as a norm. And I wasn't going to be excluding myself from knowing more people, regardless of what that may cost me.
Where do you think those values came from?
Ironically, I think that my father, he was bipolar and also an alcoholic, and he had psychotic breaks. But he also was very concerned about ethics and values and discussed it constantly. So every night we sat at the dinner table at 6 and would discuss what went on during the day. And it would have to be a very philosophical conversation, also political, also having to do with theology. It got me into a mode where conversation was completely normal. My opinion mattered. All of our opinions mattered. So it never occurred to me, like other women that I got to know later on in life, where they felt like their contribution was irrelevant or less than a man's. It never even occurred to me. So it helped me begin to write. When I was 24, I wrote my first poem, Welcome to the World of the Good Intentioned. For my children, I had 2 children by then. They were biracial, and of course they still are. So at the time at 24, I wanted them to have an idea of who their mother was in case I died young. So I began to write a book for them. And in that piece, as a white person, I was beginning to understand my own position in society as a white person of privilege. And I was also trying to juggle my responsibility as a white mother of black children. To what extent am I able to give up my white privilege as I raise them and try to empower them to not think they're less than because of racism? And also finding out that I can't do that because white privilege is such a hard thing to fight and disown when you're not a racist, regardless of what class you're in, regardless of what tragedy you may have experienced, that it's not the same as a tragedy of people of color being dismissed, being invisible, being considered unimportant, and having their legal equal rights taken from them again and again and again in many, many situations every single day. And understanding that I was going to have to reconcile something about that along the way for myself, and then gradually began to do that through the work and through the writing and choosing to work in places where maybe I would be the one white person among people of color. You know, going out of my way to not be in the majority. And that was very helpful and very nourishing.
As a white mother raising black children, at that time, did you feel like your children were biracial or black, or those terms could be used interchangeably based on how they're perceived?
It's a wonderful question. I think that there are several ways to answer this question, so I'll go for each way. One thing that I noticed in white people is that they would say, well, why do they have to be biracial or black when they're really part white? And I'd go, because the Ku Klux Klan will never consider them white. Because mm-hmm. part of the thing you have to deal with racism is the violence of it, that people of color are always under attack, if not psychologically, then verbally, if not verbally, then physically, if not physically, then fiscally. So the fact that they're biracial, this real serious racist couldn't care less. As far as they're concerned, they're black. But when George and I raised them, I was very happy. I was like, I have black kids. I was thrilled. Well, I loved George. It was a wonderful mm-hmm. thing to have children right away. Mm-hmm. I think you're lucky if you're young and in love and you have a responsible relationship to one another and it's mutual. I think that's one of the most incredible blessings you can start out with in life. Mm-hmm. But, and then if I would say biracial, the expressions in people's faces would be interesting. And a great deal of prejudice from blacks, especially. Like, biracial, what's that? Because actually in the community at the time, this is the 70s, black was black, and you need that kind of solidarity. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So we're not going to distinguish between whether they're white and black or Spanish and black or at the time. Nothing's been changing. Dialogue's been changing. Trends have been changing. Self-images have been changing. For the most part, you know, my kids are perceived as black. Here's one aspect of being a biracial child that we experienced in my family. That you're vulnerable and you know that you're vulnerable. If you look to the mother, you're not going to see what you're going to be becoming. Mm-hmm. You're going to remain biracial. So for children who love their mothers and emulate their mothers, et cetera, as a model, we'll never have that kind of particular thing that other families have, mm-hmm. where the model for who you want to become, you know, like with my daughter, won't be to end up like my white mother. That'll never happen. Mm-hmm. So you're taking a different road together, both of you. Your journey is going to be quite different. Mm-hmm. And it's going to change the relationship to one another from time to time. Same with a son. Yeah. So for biracial children, their reality is to carve their own way in the world as who they are. A few members of my family accepted me and my relationship to George, so I was kind of punished for it. I was locked up in a room for it to keep me away from him. All this drama, a lot of hatred. Mm-hmm. They went to the church that we weren't going to be allowed to be married. They tried to get the bishop to refuse to allow us to be married in the Catholic Church. All this opposition. So it took a while, it took several years for me to be willing to integrate the white side of my family into my children's lives. Mm-hmm. And white people were basically oblivious. Like, they never asked us a question about our biracial family at all. Even if I was really close and had a white friend, they'd never go, well, what's it really like having biracial children? Never. Mm-hmm. I mean, those relationships dissolved.
Why was racism invented?
Well, really, for classism purposes, in order to... The whole aspect of it is that blacks never recover from slavery entirely, that they're always somehow or other enslaved, whether it's psychic enslavement or physical enslavement. You know, that's really the point of it, is to keep that going.
Mm-hmm. Or prison.
Precisely, yeah. Prison to pipeline. There's a delusional aspect to white consciousness because of the perversion of power that they've had over people of color. Mm-hmm. So the only way in which it's going to get worked out is if it's all brought into consciousness, because mm-hmm. that's the thing that allows us to take action. So it really needs to be discussed more. It needs to be discussed in school more seriously, and it needs to be discussed in schools from middle school onward. And how are we recovering as a nation from slavery, from the fact of what we've done? The Holocaust against black people. Mm-hmm. In several years, blacks may not be able to vote again, and people don't even realize that. Okay, when President Johnson signed the Voting Act, it was only good for 25 years. That was 65. I came here from New York, and I had had different kinds of jobs in social work and in as a singer, and... I had decided to go to school when I was around 43. I went to Holyoke Community College first because I had left the private Catholic girls' college I was in because of the racism I was experiencing. It was too overwhelming, so I quit. But then I decided at 43 to go back to college, so I went to Holyoke Community College first for a year, and then I happened to transfer over to UMass at Amherst. And this would be 1993 or 4. And... the racism on campus was outrageous, and even in the classrooms I noticed that the students were, even in women's studies, were resistant to discuss the truth about what they felt. And I just felt this underlying shame in white people that I felt was very, very, very fitting, of course, but also something that does not get tapped into enough, because it indicated a kind of guilt and a kind of sorrow about the condition of racism. And a lot of white people didn't want to end up being racist mm-hmm. and felt they were overwhelmed by the culture and that they may end up being as racist as people in their families may be. Mm-hmm. And they really didn't want that route, to go that route at all. And in one class, there was a black teacher and she had dreads. And the students, she did cultural anthropology and was telling us about this situation of coming over from Haiti and all the risks taken and the lives lost in that process. And students were so angry, it was 300 students, and many of the white men in particular would send her death threats and tell her that she's lying, this can't be true. And it was just, the reaction was so violent. Mm-hmm. So I thought, let me design a course that I can teach on this subject, because I have enough of a history in this to mm-hmm. maybe be useful here. Mm-hmm. So I designed a course called Let's Talk About Race, and it was about discussing dating and when you first realize the person you're dating might really be a racist. And what do you do? Do you continue dating the person or not? I mean, is racism a good enough issue between you to dissolve the interest in the person or not? And if so, why? If not, why? And let's discuss some of these things that happen on a daily basis to us and work the racial equality muscle, I call it, and learn how to speak up. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of passivity inherent in white consciousness, I believe, about racism. And I think some of it has to do with a lack of information about it to begin with, a lack of exposure. Mm-hmm. So that when you first are considered a racist or you first are concerned about racism in a certain environment, you really don't have the tools or the skills to deal with it because mm-hmm. you really don't understand what racism is. When you start to unravel racism in your relationships, it's going to mean serious change in the relationship. There's going to be tremendous resistance, apathy, sometimes anger, and sometimes loss. And that's just a reality. So you have to be willing to accept change in your life when you're willing to tackle racism in your personal life and professional.
I'm going to stop right there for a minute. The day that I was interviewing Kaylin, I got home to find this note on my kitchen table from my friend Kristen, who I'd sold a bike to at the bike lab. It says, "Hey, Ruthie. A quick heads up that you might get a phone call from a police officer verifying the identity of my bicycle. I had to break into my bike lock upon losing my key in Boston and so attracted people's and police's attention. I received full benefit of white privilege and being allowed to proceed, but was asked for info on where I got the bike, and I gave your info." Just an example of people, you know, white people trying to think about how their privilege affects them, because I know that for a lot of us, I know for myself, I don't even fully comprehend all the ways. So that's part of the reason I wanted to have this conversation with Kaylin. We're going to continue here.
Do you have any suggestions on how to bring it up with people you're close with and reduce the likelihood of the other person being very defensive and shutting down?
I don't think you can reduce that. I think what you can do is be more certain of how much you care about it. And one way to present it is, "I care about this a lot." And I think there is a difference, though, between benefiting from white privilege and being a racist. I really mm-hmm. do. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of white people who are not racist, but mm-hmm. they are benefiting from white privilege. Mm-hmm. So if racism is part of what's normal in your culture, you're going to be absorbing it unconsciously first. And then it's going to work out, again, get it worked out as you work out other aspects of your childhood and adolescence.
Can you talk about white privilege a little bit and how that manifests and how to recognize that?
I think that with white privilege, it's so systemic that it is in the law. It's so much easier for a white person to get away with doing something against the law than a black person. I mean, and also, white people have traditionally inherited more money than blacks have, because so much money was taken away from them during the Reconstruction period and soon afterwards. So all kinds of rights were taken away from black people. Even the right to own property was. So, you know, this is why slavery is so important. It's not even only so important because it existed and what that was, but post-slavery laws were absolutely devastating because it was the end of slavery and all of these opportunities and all of these benefits that are normal to white people were not given for blacks. Mm-hmm. So it put people and generations at a total disadvantage again and again and again. I can't tell you how many white people I know have gotten some kind of inheritance mm-hmm. from white relatives. You too, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And we can be talking $10,000 or $50,000 or $100,000. I know white people who can borrow money from another white person in a minute when they need to. If you have 10 white friends, two of them are going to have money that they can lend you. And I'm talking $200 to $500 to $1,000 to $3,000 in a minute. Even with the recession, white people are still able to borrow money more easily from one another than, say, a black person can from another black person. This is what I'm aware of in my circle. And that's all the result of white privilege. If you go for a job, the likelihood of you being hired, even if the other person has better qualifications, even if the person of color has better qualifications, you're probably going to get the job because you're considered safer. You're considered less threatening than the black person. Do I think you've developed prejudices or biases that you may be not even that conscious of? Yes. Why? Well, because of the news. Every time there's a black criminal on the air, they darken the screen to make him look more more frightening, I guess, because it's in darkness. If it's a white convict, they're in white. There's white around the screen for them. They're not, there's no, not this imposing this darkness onto the screen about them. Have you ever noticed that? Where I work recently, there was a white woman, and some, of course, we have black staff and white staff, and people ask each other to go out to drink afterwards, you know, after the end of the day, like, that's real normal, and some people are into it, and some people are not. So one new staff said, oh, do you want to go out for a drink, to a white woman? She got really scared, did a concern sheet about him the next day, because he asked her to go out. Meanwhile, she had just finished telling me a week before that this other white guy has been hitting on her constantly. She's been saying no, she's not interested, no, no, he does it anyway. So he's really, like, pursuing her against her will, which can be stopped, you know, if she's assertive enough, but she's not yet. But she didn't report him. There's still this incredible silence regarding racism, which is why I wrote my book. And also why I'm having monthly support meetings starting February 21st at 2 o'clock. On called What's Next, I Can't Breathe. And there's support group meetings for people of color and their allies. So we can get together and really discuss fear and discuss what there is to be afraid of and how do we resolve that and how do we learn how to live with it and how do we work together so that there can be more assertion of our own power in relation to racism and dismantle it and be there for one another as we get harassed. Everyone's welcome. It'll be every month. And you can call 413-341-3503 for more information. Henry White and I are writing a book called Protocol, Welcome to Paradise, Watch Your Step. Henry is the producer and the host of Spotlighting Paradise, NCTV's Spotlighting Paradise. And we've been working on this for about a year, and it should be out probably in the fall. And it's going to be published by Levelers Press. We've been interviewing African-American men specifically in the Valley. We are still working on it. We're going to be done with it by June 1st and then would expect it to be coming out in the fall. Mm-hmm. So we're excited about that. And that's Protocol, Welcome to Paradise, Watch Your Step. And then when you start to get fully engaged and involved, you realize how hard it is in certain moments when you've been trained to shut down, trained not to care, trained not to notice. And then trained to be afraid. There are consequences for speaking out. Mm-hmm. But they're wonderful. They're nourishing.
The next comment, I think, if I remember correctly, it's sort of out of context, but Kaylin was talking about therapists in the Valley and how they need to have more training. Well, since there's so few therapists of color, how the white therapists need to have more training about how to provide services for people of color and what they're dealing with.
The illusion of safety here and the emphasis on protection and safety and wellness here is a total joke to me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, it wasn't that quote, sorry. No, the police sirens in the background were just purely coincidental. So you've been listening to Out There. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. I've been playing an interview with Kaylin, author of Talking About Race, a workbook about white people fostering racial equality in their lives. I've got about 10 more minutes of that interview with Kaylin, but we're going to take a little break first. Did I say this is Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP, Northampton, 103.3 FM, and streaming online at valleyfreeradio.org. You can also see back or hear back issues of this show on weatherbeard.com/Ruthie. This is Tracy Chapman.
Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds? Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, it sounds. We'll be right back. rise up, get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about the revolution. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about the revolution. About a revolution, ooh, while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh no.
That was Tracy Chapman. You're listening to Out There. I'd like to make an announcement about there's an event coming Tuesday, January 6th at First Church at 7 p.m. called Looking Beyond the 114th Congress, A People's Vision. As the new Congress takes hold in D.C., we're taking time to articulate our visions for our country. We're bringing together groups working for change to celebrate what they're doing. We can't wait for Washington to lead. Join us in our pledge to work for a better world. There'll be local organizations talking about what they're doing, hopefully to share inspiration. The keynote speaker is Falguni Sheth from Hampshire College, a Salon.com contributor. Again, that's next Tuesday, the 6th at 7 p.m. at First Churches in downtown Northampton. Something else that happened this week that I noticed was the first passenger Amtrak train came into town on Monday. I missed the arrival of the train, but I did run into a couple of excited passengers walking down, or people who had gotten off the train walking down Pleasant Street. So I talked to them for a couple minutes.
We just got off the train from Greenfield. Mm-hmm. It was really very nice. It was
very
just
exciting
to be able to come here so quick. We saw some guy mooning.
Mooned you?
Yes.
He was up in the woods about 5 miles north of here. Deliberate.
It was the deliberate moment.
He made the trip.
How long did the trip take?
About 25 minutes.
Nice. It was really nice.
It's very exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, to be on the first train, you know.
Yeah. So you're all gonna have lunch here in Northampton?
Yes,
we are.
We'll
go back on the 4 o'clock train to Greenfield.
I also have another story from this week that my friend Angie, who works for Simple Diaper and Linen in Holyoke, she shared with me when she was dropping the diapers off at my house for the Northampton deliveries.
So what happened, Angie, on your way to work this morning?
Well, I took the bus down to Holyoke and rode my bike down Main Street. And someone threw an egg down at me from like a four-story window. And
But it missed.
It landed to my left about 6 inches out. And I looked up and was like, really? And I could see the curtain kind of like flowing. They're, you know, they were probably sad that they missed.
Pretty awesome.
Oh, Holyoke.
We're going to go back to the interview with Kaylin. That's my friend Mike on guitar. Okay, here's Kaylin.
Well, one of the traditional samples, and it happens here all the time in this town, is a black man going to a store to buy something, and they're followed right away. There's an attitude right away, so if the person calls them on it, the person is defensive. What happens then is usually white people will gather around to defend the white person, even they don't know what just happened. This happened at Stop and Shop recently, where somebody was on a line for the 12 or less items and was on that line, and then a person came and asked him, could you go to this other line for some reason or other? And he said, well, but I'm on this line because I only have 2 items. And they said, that's okay, just go to the other line. So first of all, dismissing him, not listening to his answer, which is totally logical and makes sense, not giving him an explanation, just, that's okay, just do it. Whereas if it was a white person there, the person would have said, oh, we need to do this because of that. White people don't tend to talk to white people like their children. But white people in authority tend to speak to blacks as if they're children when they're questioning something. So he goes, well, I'm really not comfortable with having to do that without an explanation, you know what I mean? So the white woman there who had asked him to move started crying and then went to her supervisor crying because her feelings were hurt that she was asked a second or third time for a reason why. And then the supervisor took her upstairs to freshen her up and came down very defensive. Why are you hurting so-and-so? Can you see a white person saying that to another white person? Why are you hurting so-and-so? Because you're asking them a question about why you need to move online somewhere. It's almost tragic, comical tragedy. And white people, we really don't relate to. Yeah. If you get in a room with, which is going to be happening on February 21st, an integrated room with an integrated setting, and we're discussing racism, it's really amazing how many white people sit there like in shock at what they hear blacks talking about happens to them every day, where they're insulted every day. If they're not threatened, they're insulted. And the defenses of white people against that, if you call them on it in the moment, in the present, because I tend to do that. Like if I'm with somebody, I will call them on it. And then they have to, take that again and again, that reminder that they're less than, that they're treated like they're a child when they're 50 or 60 years old, that they don't know what they're doing, that they have no right to speak, that they can't speak in a particular way. They can't question authority. Do not question authority if you're black. Don't do it. Because you're totally expendable. You're completely disposable then. You know what I mean? Completely. So you got to be a nice person all the time. You have to be nice no matter how mistreated you're being or how insulting a situation is. The survival etiquette is extremely intense. When you are talking about racism, you have to take isolated incidents and you really do need to discuss them. The roles that each person is playing and then the right person and then what's happening with the black person or what's happening to the black person, because for the most part something's happening to them that's involuntary. Imagine going through the day figuring out, gee, should I go back to CVS because they don't really want me there? At another store, a bagel store on Main Street, a black guy was there just with his laptop a couple of months ago, and they told him to leave. Well, who else is there with their laptop? And they said, no, you gotta leave, you can't just hang out here. Well, why? There's 4 of the white people hanging out here. It's a bagel place. I'm sitting down, eating a bagel. And they told him he had to leave. And he went to people involved in politics in town to say, why would I have to leave? This is totally wrong. And they said, well, maybe there's something we can do about it. Like they're doing a big favor. And then they go to find out what they can do. Oh, they found, oh, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do about it. Oh, well, it's too bad. I'm really sorry it happened to you. They discussed it among one another and decided that it wasn't important enough to do anything. The element of powerlessness, the element of not taking it seriously, and then going back to the person and going, I'm sorry, there's really nothing we could do about it. I'm so sorry it happened to you. It's a shame. It's a shame. Isn't racism a shame?
Ferguson's
it's
a real shame.
Oh, man, it's tough. But no, there's nothing I as a councilman can do for you. I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do in a small town for you. But bring a white child in who's been bullied in the neighborhood, and we'll see what they can do about that. The concept of white people needing support from another white person because they're upset about what happened with a black person. Those are just a few little samples, but we have a great deal more in the book. In your environment, whatever the environment is, when you see a racist interaction, one of the first things I do is myself is write it down, and I encourage others to write it down. Because you want the memory of what took place to be very fresh. Because later, a day or two later, you're going to interpret it differently. You'll forget something that's very significant. So I go home and I'll write it down. And then I'll keep track of it. I'll keep track of, is there a repetition here of some form of abuse? Because really, we refer to abuse of children and women and men, domestic. But what about racism? Racism is total and complete abuse. It's complete abuse. when you start to become conscious of racism and how frequent it is, and the effect of white privilege on our interactions with one another, even with whites among whites. Because the more conscious you become of racism, the more conscious you become of the effect of white privilege, and then the more conscious you become of your dialogue with other white people. And it's really disconcerting. So it's good to write it down and then see how frequent that pattern is and see where you're getting stuck and where you're being quieter when you don't really want to be quiet. Mm-hmm. But if you write it down, you'll be more able to go back to it later on when you're a little more together about it. The whole point is that you're not going to be convincing or beating someone up over the head about changing who they are. It's about changing who you are. Mm-hmm. It's not running out in a group necessarily and being part of their group dynamic. That can be very illusory. Mm-hmm. And it can be very reactive. And it can have a lot to do with every other thing but racism sometimes. But you want to really go internally and find out where you're really at about racism. And where are you prejudiced? Where are you really, really messed up when you didn't think you were? Because we all are.
One of the things you talk about in your book is unearned status that the white people have. Can you explain that a little bit?
One part of white culture that I've always gotten a kick out of, even when I was a little girl, was when people go, and I did it all by myself, and I did, or I inherited, or I worked really hard for this. Well, I'm entitled. I really worked. I really deserve. I really did this. In white culture, we are able to say that we as individuals are responsible for our successes. We work alone. In black culture, that's rarely the case. Usually it's, you know, a real conscious awareness that any progress that I've made is the result of other people who have progressed before me, given me this space and this opportunity. But white people tend to have a more of a self-centered sense of having achieved what they've hoped to achieve in their lives. But the fact is, when there's so much racism in this culture, white people are not fully and justly responsible for their successes. Because how many people could have been in your place if racism wasn't intact? You probably wouldn't be where you are today right now. Mm-hmm. And this is the problem. This is the ultimate threat in white culture and with white privilege. That when racism gets dismantled, we're all working on basically the same line. We're all coming from a similar place. Mm-hmm. So it's never really true. It's always illusory success because it's always been at the expense of so many people who also should have been and could have been where you are, but they couldn't possibly be because they weren't allowed to be because they weren't even in the equation because of racism.
When you say, like, where I am, you mean, like, white people, the way, like, the inheritances, the way money's passed down, property,
jobs, homes, access to schools,
education, schools, exactly, all housing.
Of that, every single healthcare, mm-hmm. healthcare. Yes, absolutely, in all those ways. There's a great deal of suffering going around social justice right now, a tremendous amount of suffering that people are conscious of and going through and willing to go through, do you know what I mean, to arrive where they want to get. Lynching is returning. And the last lynching was in the 60s. And one young man, Lenny Lacey, was just recently hung in a playground.
Sorry, I clipped that wrong. The name was Lenny Lacey. He was hung on a playground in North Carolina on August 29th, 2014.
With a different belt on than his belt and a different pair of shoes. Mm-hmm. And that was a hanging. And he was about 17, I believe he was 17.
And what's happened since then?
They don't know what's happened yet. There's now a formal investigation. What they tried to do at first was say that he committed suicide. Mm-hmm. And obviously he hadn't. Mm-hmm. And then several weeks later, but because of several other murders, they're going back now and formally investigating it. But, you know, good luck with the investigation.
A couple other things about his hanging was that it was 59 years and one day after the murder of Emmett Till, and Mr. Lacey was also dating a white woman. It was in Bladenboro, North Carolina. Not that that really matters.
Many people are wondering what's next. You know, what am I supposed to do? Because a lot of people seem to really get it and began to talk to me about it. Like, all of a sudden it hit white people. Like, what's going on here? You know, even in the most fundamental way, what's going on here? How can these young men be murdered this way? And how can nothing be done about it? What's next is going home and discussing how deeply racism impacts your family and has impacted you. We've all been violated and hurt and abused if we've been raised to accept racism.
The only other thing I think of right now is about how we're all oppressors and oppressed in some way. Like, right. We look at all the isms around.
Sure, exactly, exactly.
And
definitely.
Like, trying to talk about racism with members of your family or with other white people.
Mm-hmm.
Being a good listener,
right,
on
exactly.
how people are
very
hurting
true.
In other ways.
Very true, yeah. In fact, in our class, we would speak only from the eye. Anyone who had made a contribution could only speak from the eye, mm-hmm. and no one commented.
That's been an interview with Kaolin, Northampton resident, author of Talking About Race, a workbook about white people fostering racial equality in their lives. If you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, here's a song from the Chambers Brothers that Kaolin requested.
We don't listen anyway. Time has come today.
That was the Chambers Brothers with Time. You've been listening to Out There. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. I've been talking with Kaylin. That was the end of that interview. I didn't have as much material as I thought. I ended up clipping it more than I... I didn't have as much time to do the editing I'd like to do. So anyway, I want to open it up to people to call in. I'll try and get you on the air if anyone would like to share. We've been talking about racism and white privilege and what white people can do. Yeah, call in if you'd like. A couple of things that I talked about earlier that Kaylin had talked about, I wanted to make a few comments on. One was where she was talking about having biracial children, she being white and her husband being black. It just got me to thinking about how it seems like when there's two parents, the one looks white and one looks black, the children are called biracial typically. But then it seems like when the children grow up, it's more likely that they'll just be called black. President Obama may be an example of that. Another thing that Kaylin and I talked a little bit about, which didn't make it into the recording, was a friend of mine who's a black man in Northampton has said that one of the things hard for him being here is how often people react to him with fear, particularly white women, which makes me think, is it ever okay to be afraid of someone who hasn't done anything to you? Is it okay to be afraid of someone because of their skin color or their physical size, their gender, their age, how they're dressed? And I think that's my immediate reaction is kind of like, no, it's not okay to be afraid of people. But if you're coming from a place of trauma where you've been abused or hurt by someone, and the person reminds you of that, I'm thinking about like sexual abuse survivors. Yeah, I can, there's room for that. I can understand that. But I think in general, trying to overcome our fears is a good direction to take. Another book that I've been reading in addition to Kaylin's is called Privilege, Power, and Difference by Alan Johnson. He's a white man, a very compassionate person who talks about all different kinds of isms and how we're all hurting in ways and we're all oppressed and oppressors in different arenas. And he's got some really good suggestions about how to in ways that you are privileged, that we are privileged, ways to try and release that, address that, and confront that. Again, that book is Privilege, Power, and Difference. I highly recommend it. He presented the information in a way that I felt like loved and not like a bad person, and that it just seemed to build community in many different ways. Something that Kaylin mentioned that she had done in her own life is to try and put herself in positions where she was in the minority, in the workplace or in social situations. And so that's something else that white people could do. Take the bus to Holyoke, take the bus to PBTA to Springfield. It's not much, but it's an idea. I struggle with how I live in this mostly white town. Like, how ethical is that to believe in integration but choose to live in a pretty segregated place? So that's something I'm working on. I'd love to hear what any callers have to say about that. I'm going to play another song here. This is They Might Be Giants.
This is when the party ends. I can't stand here listening to you and your racist friend. I know politics bore you, but I feel like a hypocrite talking to you and your racist friend. It was the loveliest party that I've ever attended. If anything was broken, I'm sure it some bullet head, the madness that is.
You've been listening to Valley Free Radio. This is Out There. Democracy Now! Is coming up at 5 o'clock. Here's a promo for another show for Friday.
Every day in the electronic media, people talk, or more likely yell, about politics.
We do things differently.
Our job is to talk about the things that we hope will be of interest to you without all the shouting and anger.
We hope to provide facts and have reasonable discussions about the issues of the day.
That is to disagree without being disagreeable.
Join us every Friday at 7 p.m. for Civil Politics here on WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton, or anytime online at civilpoliticsradio.wordpress.com.
Another thing that white people can do to confront racism is to try and work on prison issues. There's some good organizations locally, like the Prison Birth Project. They work on the rights of pregnant women in prison in Western Massachusetts, I think, mostly. Voices from the Inside is a writing group for women in prison. I'm sorry, I'm spacing on Lois Ahrens, the name of the prison reform group that she's part of. Prison is a really big issue. Incarceration also affects people's right to vote. If you have a felony conviction in most states, I believe, you lose your right to vote. EPICA is another prison-related organization, ex-prisoners organizing. Sorry, I forget them. They're based in Worcester. All right, here's another clip I have from Harold downtown.
Good morning. My name is Harold Cannon. I'm here with Ruthie, and I love to thank the volunteers at the shelters for the they volunteering and they cooking. God bless you all. Love you.
So tomorrow starts in the new year. Be careful today. I've heard of some crazy stuff going on today already, including the glass door of an office downtown, having a brick thrown through it by someone who was high, including some of my coworkers eating cookies that were tainted with something and being unable to finish work. There's lots of first night activities going on downtown. And I'm going to play this song by They Might Be Giants.
Marching on, and time is still marching on.
This day will soon be at an end, and now it's even sooner, and now it's even sooner, and now it's even sooner. This day will soon be at an end, and now it's even sooner, and now it's sooner still. Ever been, and now you're even older, and now you're even older, and now you're even older. You're older than you've ever been, and now you're even older, and now you're older still.
Thanks for listening to the show today. This has been Out There with Ruthie Woodring. stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up at 5 o'clock.